Hello, everybody. This is David Bixenspan here with a new edition of Cageside Radio here on CagesideSeats.com as part of Sports Blog Nation. And I am joined by a very special guest, the first UFC 205-pound champion, legend in MMA, currently announcer for Strikeforce on CBS and Showtime, the one and only Frank Shamrock. How are you doing today, Frank?
I'm fantastic. Thanks for having me.
So we ended up setting this up, I guess, in part because you are doing an appearance with some of the EXE fighters and your fellow announcer, Mauro Ranallo, at the opening of a medical marijuana dispensary and alternative medicine clinic in your hometown of San Jose, and wanted to start, I guess, by you talking about why this is important to you.
Sure. Well, you know, my father passed away about two and a half years ago now. And he had lung cancer. He had mesothelioma. And, you know, the past 8 months of his life were just terribly painful and terribly uncomfortable for him. And, you know, I watched him pass that way. And dealing with pain is something I do every day from my career and from my lifestyle choice and because I got a broken spine. And, you know, it just makes no sense to me why every effort available is not made to help people relieve pain. And if it's an herb, if it's a rock, if it's a tree, who cares what it is? I just want the people to have it because it makes no sense to be in pain. And if I can help people alleviate some pain by showing up and hanging out and shaking hands, talking about MMA, sign me up because that's what I'm there for.
Okay. And how did you end up specifically setting up this appearance with this specific clinic?
Well, I met Doug in a social setting, and Doug's the CEO and driving force behind the MedMare clinic and the compassionate care movement there. And, you know, he asked me if I was interested in compassionate care and if I knew anything about it. And I told him the story of Joe, but, you know, the first Make-A-Wish Foundation wish I ever granted was for a young girl named Angela Espinosa, and she ended up passing away when she was 14 years old and a massive tumor in her stomach. But the same thing, after, you know, medicine exhausted their supply, after the doctors and Kaiser exhausted their, you know, finances, they basically sent her home to die. And, you know, she spent a week in terrible, terrible, terrible pain. And so out of it that she couldn't spend time with her family, you know. And but to me, that makes no sense. If there's a relief out there, give them the relief. That, you know, Dave, as soon as Doug said anything to me about helping people with pain, I was like, sign me up and I'll bring my boys. So we believe in helping people, and we think this is a positive thing to do.
I guess for those who aren't familiar with it, because it's pretty much, I think, just California and maybe one or two other states that have the medical marijuana laws, to the best of your knowledge, what is the distinction in California that makes it different from most other states?
Well, in California, we have Proposition 215, which allows a medical doctor to prescribe for pain management or any type of other chronic or illness, you know, medical marijuana as a medicinal substance, mm-hmm. But both for appetite and for pain, for, you know, all kinds of different things. It's a crazy herb and, you know, plant that has a million uses, and why we're not using it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Alrighty. So I guess, you know, before I get into some of the other questions I have, since we have Fabricio Werdum versus Fedor Emelianenko card coming up in a couple weeks, I think the same weekend that you're doing the appearance at the grand opening, just wanted to see if maybe you could go over your predictions for the card.
Oh, predictions.
Yeah.
Well, we'll start at the top. I mean, I'm looking at this. I've been watching fight tape on Werdum and Fedor. And I mean, Werdum really got to, you know, got to take a bite out of that pie because, you know, Fedor just stylistically matches up badly with him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Werdum is kind of flat footed. He's got speed, but his power seems to be questionable at times. His balance seems to be a little bit off. I think you just got to get this fight to the ground and start working on a long match. Mm-hmm. I think Werdum can win this if he turns into a wrestling match and he makes him wrestle. He makes tries to wrestle and tries to spend time on the ground. He didn't want submission opportunities and ground and pound opportunities. Past that, Taylor's going to clock, and he's going to drop if he doesn't get it down.
Okay. Now, okay. So you think the key is real is taking it to the fourth and fifth round then?
Yeah, I think he's got to get him late. Because, you know, Fedor seems to get a little bit tired, and he certainly takes more damage later on, early on and later on. Mm-hmm. So I think he's got to wrestle. He's got to get him in a wrestling match where he's expending energy and opening up submission opportunities for Verdum.
All right. Now, what about Christian Cyborg Santos versus Jan Finney?
I just see Cyborg destroying every woman. I think she's just too strong and advanced as an athlete. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just keep watching her, and I'm like, you know, I mean, she's rotating completely through her hips and shoulders. I mean, she's punching, you know, she's got massive power, unlike any other girl out there.
I just think
she's going to smash this poor girl.
Do you think that even, you know, even if there was less of a gap in skill between Cyborg, that at least as you see it, between Cyborg and her opponents, do you think that also the size difference in this fight is probably too much for Finney to overcome?
I think it's size, and then Cyborg is a different level of athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for a woman, she's a different level of athlete. She's an upper echelon, you know, athletic woman caliber. And most women aren't at that level in our sport yet. They're martial artists, they're strong women, they're strong athletes. But, you know, Cyborg is a genetic freak like me. She has gifts above and beyond. I mean, I don't work out. I'm shredded, I'm ripped. You know, I can get in shape in a week. She has a genetic gift. And if she trains and hones those, she has to meet another genetically gifted person in order to compete at that level, because I just think she's going to out-athlete every other girl she meets.
All right,
and that right hand. Oh man!
So instead of going to the whole card, let's just finish out then with Kung Lei versus Scott Smith in the big rematch.
Yeah, that's a tough one to call. I mean, I part of me thinks Scott Smith is going to wade through him because he doesn't feel the power. I mean, Kung Lei really unleashed everything he had on him, and it didn't do anything. But part of me thinks he'll wade through it, and part of me thinks that Kung Lei will play a smart, strategic game, and we're going to see him wrestle.
Alrighty.
And I think if Kung Lei comes out and wrestles and ground and pounds and plays a patient game, I think Kung Lei will knock him out late.
Okay. So now a bunch of questions I want to go into about your career, since at Cage Side Seats we have a little bit more of the pro wrestling slant than the other sites on SBN. Figured try to get in as much about Pancrase and related questions as I can. So, to start, let me just see what I had. Oh, actually, before I get to that, I wanted to ask probably the most relevant wrestling-related question, though, at the moment. With all the Batista rumors, what do you think about him going into MMA?
I think anybody that's a star who comes into our sport and brings fans is a positive thing. And honestly, I didn't follow his career in wrestling because I kind of got out of wrestling when he was in his, you know, kind of heyday.
Mm-hmm.
So I know of his name. I know of his value. I know of his fan base. I just don't know him personally. I haven't hung out with him or seen his work. But, I thought Brock Lesnar was awesome. You know, we need people, first off, that are stars, and then second, who can carry the storyline from point A to point B. Because it is a story, and it is entertaining.
Well, I'll use that then to segue into another question I had, which is that, you've sort of gained a reputation as having some of the better interviews in MMA, especially during the Phil Baroni build-up. So I wanted to ask, what wrestlers influenced your interview style the most?
I'm sort of an old-school wrestling fan.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I caught wrestling when I was a kid. It's what got the bug. It was the Hulk Hogan era. It was the, real glitzy glamour. And I didn't get to watch a lot of it, but the stuff I saw was powerful to me because I was attracted to it for whatever reason. Wasn't that big of a fan. But I liked Hulk Hogan, I think, because of his kind of morals and his, doing right by things. Cause he was kind of a big, I would say he was my biggest influence. But what was unique about me is I took my, character really from the martial side, the martial arts side. Mm-hmm. Because on the other side, like Chuck Norris was sort of my role model. Mm-hmm. So I sort of combined the two, in my opinion. And then added a bit of, I don't know where I got the third element. I don't know where I got the crap talking element. That was always like a little Ted DiBiase-ish or something. I was always just trying to sell the truth and make it sound, either really good or really bad. He just reminded me of like he could always tell the truth no matter how, greasy it was. Ted's onto something there. So I think those were kind of my three influences.
Now, do you think that more fighters should sort of try to utilize YouTube like you did leading up to the Baroni fight? Or do you think it just sort of depends on the fight, that since that was a bigger fight, that it worked better than it would for an undercard fight or whatever?
Well, I believe that every fight is a story. Every fight, is a play. And, you bring your people to the play and you put on a display, you put on your show. Every fight should be a process. This is my opinion. It's why I think I've been so successful in building my brand is, it's always the next fight and we got a beef. It's either good or bad. I'm a bad guy or a good guy. Because people want basic storylines that they can follow and they want to be interested. And for me, I just pick on the truth. I got goofy teeth. I got bad hair. Bill stutters. It's like, it is what it is. And people don't usually talk about it, but when you're building a fight, it's a great thing to talk about. Because it gets people interested. And I think everybody should build their fight. We're in sports entertainment. If that part didn't matter, then it would just be about the technical side of fighting. And it's not.
Okay, then. So, as far as making it entertaining, want to ask, as far as Pancras, nowadays especially, you hear a lot of stories about how in the first few years, either worked fights or the more experienced guys carrying fights to get them go longer. What did you observe personally in terms of that?
Personally, I observed me working my ass off every time. And the truth is, I would have never known anyway. I think there were people that helped carry me and helped me move along because frankly, I turned pro in 8 months and I would go out, the bell would ring, I'd just bite my heart out. No one ever approached me, no one ever talked to me, I was never, set up or anything. But I think that beginning generation was so good that they could do whatever they wanted to. Mm-hmm. I just think that, much like the old days of wrestling, there's a level of skill where I could wrestle for 5 hours if I had to. Mm-hmm. Because I know it. I know every move. I know how to conserve my energy. I know how to, I know my body. I know how to put on a show. I know how to do it. If you don't, you blow your wad. It takes so much and it exhausts you. So I think there was all kinds of crazy stuff going on back in that day when we were creating MMA and becoming a hybrid style. Mm-hmm. But, no one ever paid me or talked to me or I don't really have any factual proof.
So it was probably limited more to the first group of guys and they didn't let anyone else in.
Probably. I imagine the old guard was like, look, there's six of us. We can get everybody in the world. We can cripple each other and do all this, or we can build this, idea. And, to me, part of building a business, I'm not against it. I don't really have an opinion on it. I fought my heart out. If guys didn't fight as hard as they wanted to or carried me, that's their own business. I tried to win every single time. I tried to be entertaining and put on a show.
So the viewpoint of it being more pro wrestling as a shoot, was that limited more to the first group of guys? Did it bleed into you in the second group or what?
We were brawling. I think that was... Because they all came from the pro wrestling world. They understood. They understood this thing. We were literally young kids just learning how to fight. And some of us had martial arts backgrounds, some of us had sports backgrounds, and other people like me were just athletes. Mm-hmm. But we didn't know anything. and they were really setting the way for. I think they were like, look, let's make this work. Let's figure it out. Because I know the skill I have. I can make anybody, I can make a 6-year-old kid look like a MMA champion when we spar and do stuff. Because I know so much about it now. And I figure, imagine what they knew back then.
All right. Now, you did eventually end up doing one pro wrestling match about 5 years ago for U Style. Yep. And I want to know how that came about and how you enjoyed doing that.
I enjoyed the training for very little. and the actual show was kind of stressful for me because I didn't really know that much about pro wrestling by way of participating in it. I knew more from the spectator standpoint. Mm-hmm. And so I was like kind of waiting for the talk to happen. Like, we're going to go over moves. Like, I didn't really know what to expect. So finally I took my own initiative and I went over to the guy's dressing room. And I was like, hey, so I want to do this bit, da, da, da. And I know you want to be strong. And I want to let you do some moves and everything. And then as soon as we got out there, he open palms me right in the lips. I forget, in Japan, everything is a stiff style because the old style's gone. So I get out there, he just haul off and smacks me. And I, who was in total boxing and fighting mode, just go nuts. And I totally just ground him into the dirt for like 10 minutes and then submitted him. And that was my pro wrestling experience. But I don't think I think he was fighting for his life because I was going pretty stiff.
One thing that, at least I tend to hear about, like, the UWF style that U Style was based on is that it was sort of the idea was that, like, until it was time for the finish, it was kind of shoot without defense, and if you saw an opening, you were supposed to take it.
It was that's what I was kind of derived from it once I got going.
Yeah.
Because I hadn't seen it, to be honest with you. I knew very little about it. I saw a couple of clips. I got there, I knew some of the players and the participants. Mm-hmm. And then I literally talked to the kid. We went to the dress. I warmed up, and I was like, I feel a little different about this. And then I went out there, and it was interesting. I felt the same vibes and energy I had in a fight, probably, which was maybe scary for him. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Now, did you ever get any other offers to do any pro wrestling matches that you turned down, or was that about it, or what?
That's the only real one. I've had a couple of indie offers, Ring of Honor has offered me a couple of little bits. And back in the day, ECW. They tried to recruit me back in the late, maybe it was 2000. Mm-hmm. After the UFC, when I retired, they tried to recruit me, and I actually went to Nightmare on Halloween in pay-per-view in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. I watched them do their bit, and I was like, dude, there's no way I'm doing that. I don't want to get killed in there. So that was my, that was it.
Now, I'm trying to remember, I think, though, several years earlier, there was someone from Pancrase that I think did do a match in ECW. I want to say maybe it was Jason DeLucia?
Maybe.
Yeah, I think someone did a match with Taz. I think it was Jason DeLucia. Let me look that up. I can't find it right now, but I'm pretty sure it was someone from Pancrase. But anyway, so let me see that now. What else did I want to go over? In Total MMA, Jonathan Snowden wrote a little bit about that your problems with Ken went back to a dispute over Pete Williams fighting in rings. And could you expand on that a little bit at all?
Yeah, that's some quality information there. there was a time, rightfully so, where Ken had left Pancrase, I was still in Pancrase, and I was trying to move into the MMA kind of genre of fighting. This is in the tail end of Pancrase, beginning of the new MMA world. And, my dad and Ken were dead certain and dead concerned that I was not a fighter, because I am a nice guy and I'm very jovial and kind and stuff. So, they decided to be this rough, hardcore dude to be a fighter. So, they immediately saw my ability to articulate and train and teach. And so they made me the teacher. Like, after 8 months, I was a teacher in the school. I trained everybody else. And then Ken went off into WWE and started doing his thing. And I started training all the guys, and I took them all to rings for a match over in rings. And I was like running a school and training all the guys and trying to be a fighter and being partying and being 25 or whatever I was. And I came home. Pete had a terrible performance against the guy he should have smashed. And I fought Yoshi Kosaka at 240 pounds. And it took me 30 minutes. I beat him 30 minutes. But Ken wasn't happy. We go in the gym, you know, 3 days later, we're all hanging out. He comes in and he freaks out, throws a computer monitor at me and tells me what a terrible trainer I am and how I'm driving in the ground and how I'm never going to be a fighter and I should leave. I was like, what? And it's like all the fighters were there. All my students there. So I was running classes and everything for him. And I think he had like a roid rage or something, popped or whatever. But runs in, runs out, and that was it for the monitor. And then I sat down and right there and there, I was like, I'm leaving this joint. And then, you know, 3 months later, I was gone. I packed up my blue boxing gloves and I drove out of Loda and made my way to San Jose.
What do you think of him coming clean about his steroid use recently in that interview? I believe it was on HDNet.
Pretty sad. And I mean, like we didn't figure it out 15 years ago. And I think it's sad. he's been lying to all these kids. You know, he's got kids out there doing steroids because of him. You got kids that are out there believing you're supposed to be doing that stuff. You know, and he's supposed to be a role model. It's sad that he's in that spot in his life where he's got nothing left but to tell the truth. And he should have been doing that a long time ago.
I remember way back when, like in the first couple of years of UFC, he would dare people to, you know, drug test him, and I'm trying to remember if he said he'd pay or whatever, but...
It was all, you know, everyone questioned him, and it was always, no, I would never do that, and, you know, sadly, it was a pedestal he was standing on, or a pulpit he was standing on, and, you know, it's like, yeah, okay. I'm just sad, because I realize that's the end of Ken Shamrock, and he's my brother, I love the guy, but, you know, that's the end of him.
So I take it then that the Blood Brothers pay-per-view is never going to happen.
I don't think so, man. Sadly, I put a lot of time and effort, money, and love into that thing. But I don't think so.
How did it end up falling apart originally?
Ken, in one of his phases or rages or whatever, went and cut another deal and, you know, stepped on our deal. So, and he lost that fight, and then my money guys called me and like, yeah, why would we give Ken Shamrock all this money? He just got creamed by a nobody. And then I fixed that, and then he did it again, didn't show up for Kenba. And now everyone thinks he's, you know, black poison. I couldn't get a penny for him.
Do you think that if you had been cleared to replace him in the Kimbo fight, that EXE would have been able to hold on longer, or do you think it would have ended up the same way, just without a different catalyst?
It would have survived. Mm-hmm. I mean, it probably wouldn't have been the ship. You know, we'd have patched it up and sent it back out to sail. So, you know, I think inevitably it would have had some serious digestion problems with the debt and the money they were spending. Mm-hmm. But you know, we would have made it through that night because we had a deal on the table for, you know, long-term CBS. And, you know, I say we because back then I was a shareholder and helping consultant and stuff. But, you know, things happen.
Now, around the time of the split with Ken was, right after that was when you formed the alliance with Maurice Smith and Toyoshi Kosaka. And, I mean, do you sort of see yourself as one of the first guys to really cross-train because of that? Or, I mean...
Oh,
yeah. Think that it was a major game changer?
Oh, yeah. 100%. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the truth is, Ken had limited knowledge about athletics and training, and most of it came from wrestling and football. Mm-hmm. So I was never taught I had to do cardiovascular training until I met Maurice Smith. He goes, yeah, you got to get your heart rate to a certain level and build your vascular system. I was like, oh, that's amazing stuff. We were all fighters. There just wasn't information available, and the athlete in our sport was not very developed. So, you know, a lot of people think, and rightfully so, I was at the cutting edge of mixed martial arts. Yes, I was, but I was really at the cutting edge of developing the professional athletes in mixed martial arts, as well as the technique. As Maurice brought the cardio and the striking and the inside fighting, and Kosaka brought the, you know, different type of active ground fighting, that was not, that was petition based, but also submission based. And, you know, the three of us were just like this weird melting pot when everybody else was sort of fighting to keep their own style intact. You know, we were really creating a new one and a new level of athlete, which was me for some time.
Mm-hmm. How much of it sort of had to do with Maurice Smith kind of changing everyone's preconceptions about MMA when he won the UFC title?
I think a lot of it was that. And then I also think a lot of it was that, you know, we kept showing up as a team, not only Maurice beating, I mean, he won the extreme title, he won the, you know, UFC title, he literally beat everybody up. And that was when he was a kickboxer, and then we sort of replicated that again a few years later in, you know, with me. So I think it just kind of cemented this idea that, you know, everything works, nothing works for long, you know, you just keep growing your body and your machine.
So I want to run through a few of the listener questions before we run out of time. First, I guess people weren't really clear on what exactly was it that led to this, to UFC, or I guess specifically Dana White hating you so much that you've been erased from history the way you have.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. You know, I really think it was, I mean, it's just business. To me, it was just business. But the business was very young and dangerous for both parties, for me and the UFC. In the beginning, they lost a lot of money. They didn't really know the product. They invested heavily in this market. They came up short the first few years. You know, and my brand was well established. And, you know, I'd already taken my brand out of the sport and was building it up and was really making it a household name. And, you know, when we met, it was just a bad time for us to be in bed together. And I was very forced, you know, to me it was, I had a future plan. I was going to be the Bruce Lee of MMA. I was going to help change the sport. I was going to help bring athleticism and honor into the sport. That was my mission. That's where I was going. And their mission was to have me fight for them. And I couldn't get them to see the bigger picture. I couldn't get them to see my bigger vision dream. Mm-hmm. And Dana, who at the time was not a very accomplished businessman, you know, he took it very personal. And I took it personal, I took it personal, because this is my sport. So we immediately butted heads, and then, you know, from that point forward, you know, I'm very vocal about what I like and don't like, and I don't think that a giant monopoly controlling all the talent and everything in the sport is good for business. And I helped create Strikeforce and a secondary industry because I see the future, which is there's plenty of sport to go around, there's plenty of fighting to go around, there's plenty of talent.
Do you think that there's anything to be accomplished by not merging WEC into UFC at this point? I mean, just because it... you know what I mean? As opposed to having the illusion of competition or whatever it is at this point.
Well, I mean, I know they've invested quite a bit in the WEC brand. Mm. And I know on television they're slowly rebranding that broadcast sort of as a UFC broadcast. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, you know, how much value is in that WEC brand. And I don't, you know, maybe merging is the way. But, you know, how many brands does Pepsi have? In, you know, in mixed martial arts, you know, you need A, a B, a C, you need your amateur show, you need a, you know, all these levels of support so you can keep this brand moving forward. To me, that makes sense in business world.
Okay, this one I have to ask, because I had not heard about this before, so I'd love to get your account of it. What happened in the altercation you had with Tank Abbott and his friends in a parking lot?
Mobile, Alabama. Yeah. Well, we had a late in the evening after the UFC. We'd had, some drinks at a local club and it was about 4 a.m. or so. And ironically, 2 taxi cabs pull up at the same time. One is mine and one is Tank's guy. Tank wasn't even there. And, we get out and we're, sort of socializing there. And one of the bigger guys, the biggest guy actually gets out and starts yelling and screaming and points at me. And says, you, and starts cursing me out. Just a drunken guy. And, I'm all calm. I kind of talk him around and down. And then he sort of reaches another level because his guys are egging him on. And he throws a hamburger at me. And he tries to grab me. And at the time, it wasn't style. I was wearing like a, you know, turtleneck sweater with like some tight jeans and like some cowboy pants. This was a long time ago. Some cowboy boots. And so anyway, I just, yeah, he grabbed me and I just end up drilling him like 30, 40 times until he got really, really short. And I may or may not have put the boot to his head a few times because I was awful mad at him. And then his boys came and got him and carried him away. And the next day he came up and apologized to me.
Well, that's awful. Nice
yeah, it was. The sad part, the funny part, it was funny to me, but he's so tall. He was like 6'8". He was a giant, which is why I was really upset that he was picking on me. You know, I'm like 5'10". But I realized he was picking on me because I was the smallest guy and I was dressed nice. So that in itself made me kind of mad at him. But anyways, I walk up to him in the morning and I'm like, oh, here we go again. I'm about to beat him up again. He comes up and he apologizes. Because he's so tall, I'm looking up under his chin and his whole chin had been held together with butterfly
bandages.
Because I was just wailing him with my chin. And I think I kicked him in the chin a few times. He's all, Frank, I'm really sorry. I just want to apologize for all that happened last night. I was like, all right, man, no worries. But since then, my legend has grew because he was so big and he was so intimidating looking. And I just smashed him.
Couple more questions and then I'll let you go. One person wanted you to sort of compare and contrast the training in a modern MMA gym versus training with Funaki and the rest of the Pancrase guys, you know, 15, 16 years ago, as well as the skill sets of the current guys versus the older Japanese guys and the Japanese trained guys.
Yeah. You know, then it was more old system. Mm-hmm. So in Pancrase, you know, everybody shows up at the same time. It's group training. If you're at a certain hierarchy, you come in at a certain time to be trained. And it's really like a big all day kind of communal thing. Mm-hmm. Very different than what's going on now in modern mixed martial arts, which is very specific, very sports oriented, limited time training. So like, the upper echelon athletes are doing like 45-minute, 50-minute training session. And then, you know, it's, you know, 30 minutes of rehab before and after. You know, in Japan, we were training for, you know, 4 hours straight. And then we eat a big meal and all take a nap and then get up and train some more. Mm-hmm. So the, you know, idea and the science behind the fighting in the United States has just gone through the roof. And there's still a lot of guys training the old way and kind of approaching it from a martial, you know, communal standpoint. But I would say the upper echelon of athletes are all training like machines and training like race cars.
So it was definitely patterned after how they came up through the dojos when they were training for wrestling.
Yep. Oh yeah. The old way. Go in, everybody warms up, everybody drills, everything.
Do you think that it took time off your career to do the heavy training like that, or do you think it just would have ended up retiring and then coming back at about the same times you did?
I definitely took more damage than I needed to because of our lack of understanding. And then I also had, you know, I had a broken spine when I was 16. You know, I got a spondylitis on my L3 and L4. So when I was 16, they told me I'd never play sports, I could be in pain for the rest of my life, and I had to have immediate surgery. And I was like, well, you know, I got this whole professional fighting and wrestling career planned. So, you know, I've been taking care of that, you know, the whole time and sort of trying to keep my body together. But yeah, I definitely took more than I probably should have.
Do you still do any of the Carl Gotch style exercises?
Nah. Now it's mostly yoga, rehab, and I swing that golf club as many times as I can a week.
Is it more specifically for the shape that you're in with the back problems, or just in general, do you think that training has evolved so much that the calisthenics that he was a fan of aren't as good a fit now?
Well, the conditioning techniques have definitely gotten old. You know, the squat, sit-up, push-ups, and leg lifts, while a staple of everything we grew up on, you know, there are better ways now. And for me, it's just, you know, it takes me an hour to get my back straight and standing 90% straight throughout my days. You know, most of my workouts and days are just planned around keeping my body straight, not letting anything get bent or crooked or flipped.
Last question I got for you then is, I guess, sort of to pick your brain, how do you solve the puzzle that is Anderson Silva?
Well, it's obviously striking. You know, I mean, it's so funny because his biggest weakness used to be on the ground. I watched him come up and you know, when he was a skinny young kid, and, you know, his weakness was on the ground. But I think, you know, if you met a strong puncher who knew the range and who could block those kicks, I think someone could break through his hands and win the style pretty good.
All right. So I really want to thank you for doing this today. A lot of fun. Everyone check out frankshamrock.com for more details on everything Frank Shamrock, including details on the MMA for Dummies book, EA Sports MMA coming soon for your favorite major video game systems, your acting career, and all sorts of other stuff like that. So, and you know, on Cage Side Seats, if you do want to, if you go to the grand opening of the Medmar Clinic and you're in the greater Northern California area, then we have the information there, you know, the press release and story about it. So, like to thank you so much for doing this, and good luck with everything.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.